This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And a hearty greeting to everybody. Welcome to The Big Picture today as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, we're going to do something unusual today. We are going to discuss the stock market. Imagine that, something we rarely ever do here on the program. Woohoo! You know, in reality, for the last 5 years, the topic we have discussed when we just talk about things, the stock market, has been the dominant topic here on the program. And for good reason. The stock market is up over 230% since the market bottom in March of 2009. Rising stocks has constituted the dominant theme of discussion right here on the program. And our recommendation, I'm sure this isn't new to you, has been for opting for dividend paying blue chip stocks. And the topics this decade have been more oriented toward the equities market versus the last decade when the focus was on commodities. And Jim, you've been very bearish on commodities such as precious metals since late 2011, especially after your bullishness on the metals in the first part of the century, especially when the Fed launched a series of money printing programs, as a matter of fact. And despite the launch of QE3 and QE4, we're actually numbering them now. You know, it reminds me of a line of succession of kings. Money went into financial assets instead of the precious metals, as many of the experts had thought at that time. So instead of hyperinflation, the world is now dealing with deflation more than it is dealing with inflation. And we've moved from a world of zero interest rates to a world of negative interest rates. And since the Fed ended taper, the equity markets have struggled. So 2016 is looking much like 2015 with just one exception, and that's precious metals. And they are at this year's top performers. Since bottoming around 1060 in January, the price of gold has risen to 1273. So gold is up 20% for the year, and gold and silver stocks are up from 40 to 60%. And now the question confronts us, has a new bull market begun? Or is this latest run-up nothing more than a bear market rally? We've seen rallies in the past that have ended up just fizzling out, and gold has declined over the last 4 years.
You know, this is kind of an interesting question. It's something that we talked about in the first hour when we had Dave Morgan on the show. And, you know, Dave brought up a point that I think is rather valid. Just as when we talk about Dow theory, when it comes to the stock market, you usually want to see the transports confirm the industrials. And Dave was talking about the white metals, mainly silver, palladium, and platinum, confirming, let's say, what's going on with gold. And you're right. I mean, if we take a look at some of these figures for the year, they're astounding. I mean, gold is up 20%, but here's the lagging. Silver is only up a little over 12%. You know, at least the stocks are confirming what we're seeing in precious metals. I mean, the stocks have taken off like a NASA space launch. You have GDX up almost 49%, GDXJ up 46%, silver juniors up 61%, and the silver stocks up around 40%. So, John, you know, a lot of the technicians are saying, well, you know, like last week we had Tom McClone, thinks that it is or looks like the beginning of a new bull market. They want confirmation, just as Dave was talking about confirmation with the white metals. In my opinion, this is the beginning of a new bull market in gold. I mean, after declining for, 4 years now, we now finally have a catalyst that has turned gold's headwinds into what I call tailwinds. And that catalyst is negative interest rates. Something that Dave and I talk about, if you look at the breakout, especially if you look at the mining stocks, that breakout began last month when the Bank of Japan went negative. I mean, Europe has had negative interest rates here for the last year. Now you have two of the largest economies in the world pursuing quantitative easing and negative interest rates. And you also had the subject of negative interest rates last month brought up when Janet Yellen was testifying up on Capitol Hill. In fact, let's play that clip because Japan had just announced negative interest rates, and you had a congressman saying, you know, we're seeing this in Europe. We just saw this with Japan. Is this something you, the Fed, is considering?
And I guess the question then is, so you've got a pretty loaded up balance sheet, and I think people are beginning to observe that the Fed is probably out of ammunition, unless you decided to go to negative rates. And if you could briefly, I'm not proposing this. I'm just observing what's happening around the world and what's happening here in our own country. I think people are waking up and realizing that the Fed really has no real ammunition left. You alluded to this some yesterday, but and I have one more question, so I don't want this to be too long, but are you considering, if things go south, which none of us hope do, are you considering negative rates? I know you had that question yesterday. Yes or no?
So the answer is that we had previously considered them and decided that they would not work well to foster accommodation back in 2010. In light of the experience of European countries and others that have gone to negative rates, we're taking a look at them again. Because we would want to be prepared in the event that we needed to add accommodation. We haven't finished that evaluation. We need to consider the U.S. institutional context and whether they would work well here. It's not automatic.
Yeah.
There are a number of things to consider. We haven't. I wouldn't take those off the table, but we would have work to do to judge whether they would be workable here.
So now, John, as you heard, they were sort of looking at it back in 2010. Instead, they went with a series of QEs. We had QE 1, 2, 3, and 4. So that actually got things humming again in the real estate market. The economy began to grow at a consistent rate, anemically. And we'll talk about that in big picture part 2 today on the program. But what you have now, and what you haven't had probably in the last 4 years, is you have a catalyst for gold, which is negative interest rates, are now, I think, a major factor in the financial markets, and it makes a very compelling case for gold. Because remember, gold doesn't pay you anything. It's a store of value. And governments and their central banks, through quantitative interest, QE, and negative interest rates, are pursuing policies that are aimed at debasing their currencies. You can remember when the Fed launched QE1 in March of 2009, all the way up till roughly about 2012, the dollar was in a downtrend, which corresponded with the rising price of gold, which hit an all-time high in 2011 when it got up to 1900. So now, with negative interest rates, it doesn't cost you anything. In other words, when interest rates, real interest rates, were higher, and this is a comment that a lot of individuals have commented and experts that we've had on the program, when you had real interest rates, it competes with gold. Gold doesn't pay you anything. Now that you have negative interest rates, this makes for an ideal backdrop for gold, which is seen as a hedge against currency debasement. So if you look at what's going on, gold is fulfilling its role as a safe haven investment and a store of value.
Okay, so why do you think gold is acting differently than the other commodities? There isn't a glut of gold out there weighing down on the market. There are no major gold discoveries like shale gold that have been reported, as there have been in oil, of course. Why has gold remained so weak for so long?
You know, I think gold is a unique asset. It serves as a store of value. It's done that throughout history. Anytime emperors or kings or presidents or prime ministers have debased the currency, gold has always responded. It's a reflection, in my opinion, of investor fears. When people become fearful, gold is a safe haven. And more importantly, it reflects something that I see happening now and unfolding, which is a confidence in government. There's a growing opinion among investors around the world of the lack of efficacy, let's say, in monetary policy and bringing about economic results. And it's something that I talked with Martin Armstrong when I interviewed him last time we had him here on the program. John, let's play that clip about confidence peaking in government last October.
You have said that, according to your cycle work, that we're coming close to a peak in government confidence. Are you still holding that view, and is October the time frame?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you can see these things coming like a train down the track. I mean, from a host of different perspectives. Why do you think Trump is doing so well? I can tell you, I just saw an internal memo from Capitol Hill. The Republicans hired a focus group to try and find a way to derail Trump. So they fed this focus group with everything that Trump has ever said that could possibly be derogatory, etc. When the group was done, they liked him even more. And the internal memo said, you guys better take this serious. You know, people are fed up with government. And some people were, you know, saying that, oh, Obama, his failed presidency will make sure that, you know, no black will ever run again. You know, they're putting it too much into a racial tone. I think what has really happened is that Obama stood up and said, hey, you know, Bush has done this wrong, that wrong, etc. And he's done the same exact thing. So effectively, you can vote for Hillary, you can vote for Bush. Do you really think anything will change? I mean, every presidential election since the 60s is vote for me and I'll make things change. And nobody ever has. So there's no way anybody's going to be able to change anything. And it has to be somebody on the outside. And this is what Trump is attracting. He's attracting people that are fed up with government on both sides. He may not be the best person in the world to be the president, but honestly, what the polls are showing, why people like him, they know it's his money and he's not bought. You can't say that with anybody else.
It is interesting that you have two candidates, one on the right, that's Donald Trump, at least as far as parties are going. I'm not sure where they're necessarily landing politically, believe it or not. And on the left, Bernie Sanders, that have done so well because the message to Washington is we've sent people in to get change done. That's what we were voting for back in 2012, 2008. Nothing changed. And people are saying, okay, you know, the establishment is not going to change. We need some kind of an alternative to go in there. And that's basically what you're seeing. You know, it reminds you of, I think, was it the Rump Parliament in Great Britain, where they finally said, you've done all the good you can do. For God's sakes, please go. All right. We need something new in here. That's what you're seeing. People are just disgusted. They're fed up. They're tied up and tangled up and nothing's changing. And that's a perception of both the left and the right.
Yeah, it's amazing that you're seeing it reflected in both parties, because I think what you're now seeing, at least in the markets are beginning to lose confidence in governments, in particular central banks, and their effectiveness of using monetary policy. It is much easier to understand gold's move if you put it in the context of what people have right now, which is global fear. After 7 years of supplying the market with bucket loads of cheap money, central bank tools are sort of running out. You heard that congressman saying that there's this general perception out there that you guys are running out of bullets. So what do you guys do next?
So here's a question. Is gold's move now a reflection of currency moves and negative rates, or is there actually more news to this whole story?
You know, I think it's a number of things. Gold's move is a reflection, I think, of confidence in government, as Martin Armstrong was talking about there, and we're seeing this reflected in this year's presidential political campaign. I mean, the more QE and negative interest rates that we see globally, I think the stronger the case will be made for the price of gold to move higher. I mean, right now, the world is in a deflationary trend, and that central banks have been trying to fight against this trend to some success. I mean, we haven't had outright deflation yet here in the United States. It's more been a disinflationary trend. But we know from studying history, John, the way you stop deflation is through currency devaluation. The Great Depression, which was probably the last time we saw real true deflation in this country, and it was major deflation, Roosevelt stopped it overnight. What was the first thing he did when he came into office? He devalued the dollar by 44%, stopped deflation dead in its tracks. And from 1933 to 1937, we had a rising stock market, an improving economy, falling unemployment, and rising inflation until basically 1937. The government raised tax rates and the Fed raised interest rates, and we went right back into a depression. And we'll talk about in part two of the big picture today that the IMF is saying the same thing. If you guys do what you did in 1937, we've got real risk out there. And so that's what I think the gold market is finally starting to sniff out. It began to sniff that out last year, and we've had this along the way, but now it's really sensing it. And I think the catalyst or the trigger point was when the Bank of Japan went to negative interest rates, because now people say it's not just Europe, it's now Japan. And then, of course, that was followed a week later by Yellen even bringing it up as a discussion on Capitol Hill.
You know, we've seen the Fed pursue lower interest rates, and when that failed, then they resorted to money printing, or what we refer to as quantitative easing. So can we actually say with confidence the central banks have really now run out of ammunition?
I really don't think so. And you've heard Yellen and various Fed governors say, oh, no, we got a few more tricks up our sleeve. I mean, there are plenty of options left, all of which are, in my opinion, all gold friendly. They still can resort back to another round of quantitative easing, which I think they will pursue that route again, which in the next downturn, that's what I expect. We'll get QE5. You know, when you look at this and understand this from the context of financial repression, the deficit is going to be approaching $20 trillion when the next president of the United States, whether it's a he or she, whoever that is, walks into that Oval Office. They're going to be sitting and facing $20 trillion of government debt. And the government cannot afford to see interest rates rise. I mean, look at it this way. Every 1% increase in interest rate cost the government $200 billion of interest expense. I mean, right now, the average rate on government debt is 2.3%. If rates were to normalize as they were in the past when you had a Fed funds rate around 5%, John, that would raise the annual expense of servicing the debt to $1 trillion annually. There's no way government's going to afford higher interest rates, which is why they're pursuing these policies of financial repression, which are designed to keep the cost of servicing that debt down. We talked about this on the show, what, a couple weeks ago, where the national debt has gone up by $9 trillion, but interest expense has actually fallen by $50 billion annually. But so QE is just one tool they have available. They have several other tools left in their arsenal as well.
Well, now you've got my curiosity up. I mean, if money printing and keeping rates low have been their two main operatives there, what else is left in their bag of tricks that they can do?
I mean, there are a number of things. They could target policies, for example, directly towards spending. One way they could do that, I mean, right now, if you look at the housing market and the automobile market, those are two sectors of the economy that have been very strong. For example, they could target by buying mortgage-backed securities, which would keep mortgage prices suppressed with the aim of boosting, let's say, lending activity. We're starting to see this now with first-time home buyers returning to the housing market because low-priced homes are not only, well, let's say they're lower priced, but also because of low mortgage rates. And finally, they can borrow from their former Fed chairman's speech, Ben Bernanke, and they could resort to what they call a helicopter drop. Washington could simply pass a major tax cut and spending bill, and the Fed would simply step up to the plate and buy the debt and in essence, really monetize it, and that would actually create higher rates of inflation. And one of the big complaints that we've seen here, why this has not worked recently, is the failure of fiscal policy. So, John, I suspect with interest rates being as low as they are, I don't think the Fed is going to get anywhere near where they're expecting to raise interest rates. And we'll see that happen next week when they release their first forecast for 2016, their first update. And everybody will be looking at the dot plots. I expect those dot plots where they figure interest rates are headed will become down. So you're going to see, in my opinion, a helicopter drop the same way we saw it. If you think back to 2009 in March, what was the first thing Obama did when he got elected? He came up with a $1 trillion spending program. And what was that accompanied by? It was accompanied by QE1, where the Fed launched $1.2 trillion of money printing to pay for it. So no matter what policy the Fed pursues, they're going to be gold favorable. And I believe the helicopter drops are more likely. Negative interest rates have some drawbacks associated with them, especially with money market funds.
Well, it's something I've been wondering about. As banks go into negative interest rates, what are the negative effects of that?
I mean, they could be detrimental to bank profitability. Even more important, negative rates could not only weaken the profitability and soundness of financial institutions with what I call long duration liabilities. I mean, think of insurance companies or pension funds. I mean, right now, a lot of pension funds in this country, mainly government and city pension plans, are at risk. One of the major issues of QE and negative rates, it has put cities and states in perilous financial conditions as a result of their unfunded pension liabilities. Many states' pension plans are using investment returns in their planning of 7 to 8%, and we're not even coming close to that. My own state of California being one of them, where recently last year, the head of CalPERS, the largest pension plan, basically said, we don't have the returns to support these pensions. We're going to have to rely on future tax increases. So pension plans, John, are hurting right now, and zero and negative interest rates will only aggravate this situation. I mean, you know, you got to fund these pensions, and something we're going to talk about on Monday's Lifetime Income Program, you got to fund these. You have to have a certain rate of return. Now, in the past, a lot of pension funds got high returns on fixed income investments. You can't put everything in stocks or alternative investments like commodities or hedge funds. In fact, CalPERS unwound their hedge fund investments. And, I mean, you take a look at the bond market today. The good news for pension funds with the widening of credit spreads that we saw since the beginning of the year, you can now start to get 4 and 5, maybe even 6% bond yields, sometimes even higher if you go out on the risk curve. But John, there's that is just one major negative outcome to zero interest rates and negative rates. It really does major damage to financial institutions like insurance companies and pension plans.
Okay, let's project outwards, and since we're talking about it, and say, where is all this leading? There must be implications, especially for investors.
We'll talk about this probably more so in BP2 today, but it is time to get defensive. We have been getting defensive across all portfolios that we manage since November of last year. I mean, we're going to be getting even more defensive as the year progresses, as we see financial storms heading our way with greater volatility this year versus, let's say, last year's rising volatility.
What has led you to draw these conclusions? I mean, because until late last year, you have leaned towards more of the optimistic side, and I'm detecting here a shift.
The problem is that not only are monetary policies out of sync right now, but monetary and fiscal policies are also out of sync. In many instances, you've seen poor fiscal policy is negating really the impact of what a central bank is trying to do. And we're seeing that, John, not just here, but we're seeing it globally from the United States to Europe and Japan. And the primary beneficiaries of QE happen to be governments and financial institutions with troubled balance sheets rather than those entities that create growth in a real economy through, let's say, productivity, entrepreneurs, small businesses, research. I mean, the kind of things that make an economy grow, we haven't seen it. The problem with QE and negative rates have mainly benefited government in the financial markets. What have you seen over the, let's say, this recovery? The financial markets have done much better, which is being used politically. The problem is really that fiscal policy has really been at odds with monetary policy, which probably explains a lot of why we're seeing economic growth that has been this anemic. And how many times, John, have we been on this program to talk about positive economic growth, and all of a sudden, the end of Q4, economic growth slows down? We had 2 years back-to-back where you had negative growth rates, and what is happening is, as what we've seen with fiscal policy, credit growth has been subpar, as many credit-worthy investors have been unwilling to borrow at any rate due to the, let's say, high taxation as well as increasing regulatory burden. You want to know why banks did not expand credit? I mean, take a look at what happened to banks with Dodd-Frank. So what we've seen in the private sector is really a lack and unwillingness to invest. Instead, companies have deployed profits pursuing policies of financial engineering, which is the private sector's response to financial repression. So rather than reinvest in new plant equipment and expanding the business, companies have said, you know what, we'll just buy back our stock. We'll increase our dividends, and we'll use financial engineering to increase profits rather than expanding the business enterprise, because there just hasn't been the incentive to invest with regulations, anemic demand, and then also higher taxation, which is one reason we have about $2.5 trillion of profits that are parked overseas that have not made their way back home. So robust, what have we seen the last 7 years? Well, we've seen robust financial markets, declining government financing costs alongside rising levels of debt, and anemic, if not stagnant, economic growth.
Okay, we need to hone in on this just a bit more, because what we need to really do here is explain how fiscal policy has run contrary to monetary policy, because this recovery was basically kickstarted by a heavy dose of fiscal and monetary policy back in 2009. So what went wrong?
Well, take a look at Europe. We were coming out of a financial crisis. Global central banks began a stimulus program in 2009 following the Fed's lead. Europe raised interest rates, worried about inflation in 2011, sent their economy back into a recession. To make matters worse, France raised income tax rates to 75%, causing its economy to stall. Japan launched a new program of monetary stimulus, but then followed it up by raising sales taxes. And then if you look at what happened in the U.S., it began with Obamacare, heavy taxation, regulation, and uncertainty. You had Dodd-Frank, which restricted lending. You had that followed up in 2012 when basically we raised income tax rates across the board. So while central banks, from our own Fed to the ECB to the Bank of Japan, were creating policies to stimulate the economy by bringing down interest rates, governments were pursuing anti-growth policies, whether it was increased regulatory burdens or also increasing taxation. And we saw that in Japan. The minute that they raised the sales tax, Japan's economy went right back into recession. We saw it in Europe when the central bank there was raising interest rates in 2011. We saw it in France when France raised income tax rates to 75%. You're trying to get the economy to grow, and at the same time, you're doing things that subtract from that growth and take away from it. And that's why monetary policy, and a lot of people have said that, it has its limitations. It works best when it works in conjunction with proper fiscal policy, as it did coming out of the recession in 2009, when the government created a fiscal spending program that basically was monetized by Fed's money printing.
Yeah, so we're back here. If we look at where we stand today, and we've witnessed the bear market in gold, with gold having fallen 45%, but now gold's on the rise. So according to your opinion, is this recent run-up in gold merely a bear market rally, as we've seen so many times these last few years, or is this really the beginning of something new?
John, there are a number of things that are going on here, both fundamentally. I think that the chief catalyst is a loss of efficacy of monetary policy with negative interest rates, but also a loss in confidence. Now, there are other fundamental factors that are coming into play here. Let's listen to a clip here from Bloomberg with Daniel Hines.
So let's talk about gold here real quick. We see global equities as well as gold all seeing gains right now. What message does that tell you?
Yeah, look, certainly I think the drivers behind the move have shifted quite significantly over the past month or two. Certainly at the start of the year, we saw the volatility in equity markets and currency markets as well really drive that safe haven bid. But that's been pushed aside as I think this shift towards negative yields in a lot of markets around the world. And certainly the easing expectations of a potential rate hike by the Fed in the US as well has somewhat helped that. So we've seen, as a consequence, some really strong flows in ETF funds for gold over the past few weeks. And that's obviously been a key driver behind the rise in gold price that we're seeing.
So, as you heard Daniel Hines there, in my humble opinion, I think this is really the beginning of a new bull market in gold. Gold, if you think about it historically, it's resuming its role as a store of value. And it's always acted that way throughout human history. It's been around and used as the ultimate currency over 5,000 years of recorded human history. So in a world where we now live, where governments and their central banks are pursuing policies that ultimately debase their currencies, well, look what's happening to gold. And we saw that happen with gold when it had its run-up coming out of the financial crisis in 2009, when the dollar was being debased with QE. So gold is the ultimate currency. So there's also a growing a loss of confidence, in my opinion, because much of what central banks do is a confidence game. So the effectiveness of monetary policy is being called into question. People are saying, look, you tried low interest rates, you brought them down to zero, you tried printing money with quantitative easing, and now you're trying negative interest rates. You know, basically, what's left? Because this isn't really working. So this bull market will have, I believe, different phases to it. But as the focus, as the folks at bank credit analysts have often talked about the debt super cycle, we're entering the final phase of that cycle with government stepping into the fray, which is, you know, this massive amount of debt. I mean, you think about it, you know, President Bush doubled the national debt from all his predecessors in two terms. And President Obama has done the same in his terms. I mean, he criticized the former president for adding on a lot of debt. But when he leaves office in January of next year, he will have added $10 trillion to the national debt under his presidency.
Okay, so if we posit that we're in a new bull market for gold, what should you be doing?
I mean, you might want to start nibbling on gold here, on any, I would call, pullbacks in gold. I personally like silver much better here, agreeing with Dave. And if you are more of a risk taker, you may want to look at some of the gold or silver equity ETFs. However, I really want to emphasize this point. Dave talked about it in the first hour. You should really place a limit on how much you invest here and be cautious of anyone that tells you to place all your bets on the table. We've seen this happen so many times. I saw this happen a lot in 2011, where people were just all chips in the gold market as it was running up to its peak at 1900. And we've had experts on the program over the years, people that are well-respected in the financial industry, John, and I have never, ever heard any of them say, you know, put all your chips in one basket. You know, most of them recommend a 5 to 10% position in gold. And that's coming from, like, we've had Frank Holmes, who actually runs a gold fund. I mean, if you're super aggressive, you're young and can afford to take risk, maybe 20%. But in my opinion, that's too much. And you might want to average in and wait for some pullbacks. But I want to emphasize that gold and precious metals should be looked more as a tactical investment, not a buy and hold investment. It's a hedge, which is non-correlated with financial assets. It is not something like a stock or bond, which you hold forever. Dividends go up. You get interest from it. You get nothing from gold. It's just simply a tactical investment. It's a hedge. It has a place and a role in a portfolio in terms of non-correlated assets or tactically.
So if we sum all of this up before we get into our next segment called The Gathering Storm, we believe now we have a new bull market in gold. It is being propelled by a lack of confidence in two institutions. Number one, central banks and monetary policy. And number two, in governments. And you can see this manifested in a whole host of different areas, especially what we've seen in the presidential elections here. Now we'll talk about the coming storm up next here on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Andrew Zatlin, the head of Moneyball Economics, joins us today on the show. And Andrew, when we spoke to you last, you talked about three cycles that you saw converging this year. You said China was slowing down, U.S. economic cycle was peaking, and we also see the Fed tightening and the easing cycle over. And then with those three things converging this year, you recommended getting defensive, raising cash, and selling future rallies. Now, I should note, we spoke to you, it was right after the new year, and of course, we did see one of the worst starts in the stock market on record. So your comments were certainly prescient, and we definitely saw, I think it was a double-digit correction. Now the market has bottomed mid-February. We saw the lows put in, and it looks like we're rallying and trying to get back about even on the day that you and I are speaking. It is Friday, March 4th, and we're about 2% below on the S&P year-to-date. What are your thoughts as we look forward on the market today?
You know, I would encapsulate it as saying short-term oversold, long-term overbought. I don't really see the wheels falling off right now, but the air is coming out of the tires. We're going to continue to see as the year progresses ongoing, I don't want to call it bearish news, but just not positive news about the economy. Yes, things are slowing down a little bit. Things are peaking. You know, the growth is going to be harder to come by. And ultimately, we're already in an environment where companies are revisiting their hiring plans, their capital spending plans, and they're starting to make those tough decisions. They're on the cusp of considering layoffs, but they're definitely in that zone of saying, we're not really going to hire that many more people this year. In fact, since late Q3, most companies have started to ease off the gas pedal when it comes to hiring.
You know, I was thinking of what we were talking about right as we went into the break right there about this drop in confidence in government. I saw another indicator of it this week. I was over at the sheriff's office and there's a line. There's a constant line of people at the window queuing up to get concealed weapons permits after they've had the training that they require here in the state.
You would never see that here.
Yeah, I know that. Here, it's a brisk business. You know, and every time something happens, more people do it. I talked to the people over at one of the sports shops that does the training for these permits, and they said things have just jumped massively. And there's a no confidence vote on the part of a lot of people on the ability of government to defend us from what might be happening in some other areas. But anyway, that's all on the side. Let's do some storm sound effects here. Stuff like that. I would get the impression last year, remember you were getting defensive toward the end of last year. It wasn't anything I said. It was in a defensive position. And based on the forecast at the beginning of this year, they look a little rockier than maybe at the beginning of 2015. So having said that, I sense that you think there's storm flags going up. There's a warning here. Is that true or not?
Yeah, I really do. And I mean, we've always talked about this in the past. Anytime you start a rate raising cycle, what's the old saying that we have here on the program? The Fed will keep raising interest rates until they break something, either in the economy or the markets or both. And even though we only had 0.25 point rate hike, which came last December, John, we've actually had more than that when you think of what the rising dollar has in effect been, a tightening effect in terms of its impact on corporate profits, on the manufacturing sector in this country, which is many believe is in a recession, and also the widening credit spreads that we've seen between, let's say, the government bond market, which is being suppressed through financial repression, and rising yields in, let's say, the corporate and the junk bond market. So there has been considerable tightening here that has already gone on. And whenever that happens, and when you have this shift, and of course, we're in a different operating environment today. We have massive amounts of debt at the federal level. We had it at the individual level. And now we have higher levels of debt at the corporate level. So we follow a number of things, everything from our leading economic indicators, both here and abroad, liquidity indicators, all of this, and then also what's going on with corporate profits themselves. And, you know, it's amazing, but it's not just us, John. It is other organizations. There have been a series of reports that have been issued recently from the IMF to the World Bank to the Bank of International Settlements saying there is trouble brewing out there, and there's been a lot of hesitancy that a lot of these international institutions are warning the Federal Reserve, hey guys, go slow here because you're likely to create some major problems here for the financial markets. In other words, you know, you can create this financial crisis. And it's kind of like people are saying, well, you know, we need to raise this sooner or later, so we might as well do it. But what we've seen, John, is all across the board. I've got several articles in front of me from the Financial Times to the Wall Street Journal to several publications with everybody lowering economic growth. And I would suspect this is what we're going to see when the Fed meets next week and they have a press conference. And the March meeting will be the Fed's first revision, if any, to their economic forecast and their outlook for interest rates and global growth. That will come next week. And I would be surprised if we do not see
lower projections for economic growth, because the IMF is warning baseline economic growth, both in the U.S., the world's major economies, I don't care if you're looking at Europe, Japan, China, is weakening. And there is a real risk here that they're talking about. You could have a policy mistake and risk derailing these fragile economic recoveries that we're in now. I don't care if you're looking at Japan. I mean, look at the policy mistake in Japan where they stimulated, they had the market going up, the yen weakening, the economy improving. Then they raised sales taxes and put the economy right back into a recession. Same thing with France. So you've really got to be, basically, these international organizations are saying, governments, you need to do something here. And what they're urging is for governments to ramp up fiscal policy, because mainly it's been monetary policy that is carrying the ball of this economic recovery going back to 2010 and 11, because we had a fiscal policy stimulus here in the U.S. and also in China in 2009 following the financial crisis. But since then, we've had mainly monetary policy, because basically fiscal policy has been dormant and stagnant and has actually been regressive when you think about rising taxes and regulation in terms of its stranglehold on the economy. So you've got international organizations that are saying, you know what, G20, you need to step up to the plate and you need to coordinate with your central banks fiscal policy rather than these negative interest rate policies, which, you know, basically aren't working. In fact, the Bank of International Settlements has called into question whether these negative interest rates are working. I mean, when Japan announced it, one of the things that happened is there was a run on safes to store money. And then also there's increased gold buying that's going on in Japan. So there's a lot of stuff that is going on here, John, that is cautionary in nature. And the IMF has been sending out these warnings for the last year and a half, and basically nobody is listening, including our own Federal Reserve. And what they're worried about is we could get ourselves into this deflationary death trap where you have this sort of what I call self-reinforcing dynamic, where you get higher real interest rates, falling output in the economy, rising debt levels, and rising unemployment. So I don't care anywhere you look around the globe today. You look at China, China's government, and everybody doesn't believe their top line numbers. They just lowered their official stated economic growth rate down into the like 6.5, 6.75 range. U.S. economic growth economists are downgrading U.S. economic growth based on what we've seen happen, transpire in the fourth quarter and what's happening in the first quarter. We're still growing. I guess that's the good news, but we're also lowering economic forecast in Europe.
Well, given that these large international organizations are warning the Fed about their actions, the Fed continues to proceed. It seems like they've got a different opinion. What do you think the disparity is here?
I think they're dealing with a number of issues. Number one is I really do think that they want to reload the chamber with bullets. I mean, you don't want to get into the next financial crisis with interest rates at zero, because what are your tools? Well, it's going to be helicopter drops and quantitative easing. And so I think that's one aspect. The second aspect is we alluded to in the last part of the big picture, which is the danger to financial institutions like pension funds and insurance companies of zero interest rates. I mean, a lot of the nation's cities and state governments could go into bankruptcy as a result of their pension obligations. There are a lot of unfunded liabilities here, and these pensions need higher interest rates. And you also need higher interest rates for the banking system to function. There's got to be a widening spread between what banks pay consumers, you the depositor, and what they can charge you, the borrower. The wider that spread between what they get to charge you on borrowing and what they pay you on deposit, the wider that spread, the more profitable banks become and the greater likelihood that they're going to have to make interest rates. I mean, you saw that this week with the ECB, which is basically if a bank will make interest rate loans in the economy to companies, individuals, they can actually borrow from the ECB at negative interest rates, meaning that the ECB will pay the bank to borrow money. It's what you have when you have negative interest rates. You pay the borrower interest rather than you receiving interest. And so the ECB is doing this. So you've got a number of things that are going on here that basically governments need to start reinforcing the things that they're doing and coordinate what they're doing rather than implement policies that could actually harm the economy. But I think the Fed recognizes they have a pension problem. They have problems in the economy with lending, and they know that spreads need to be widened, and they know they don't want to be at a zero interest rate policy. I think they're fearful of what they've seen happen in Japan. Now, realize, for those of you that have seen negative interest rates or low interest rates here in the U.S., think of Japan. They've been near zero interest rates since 1990. Here we are, what, 25 years later? And we're still dealing with low interest rates. Now they're negative in Japan. And I think that's the fear that they have, which is why the IMF has been sounding this warning. Be careful what you're doing here, because you could find yourself into a deflationary death trap, much in the same way that the Fed reversed policy along with fiscal policy in 1937 and put the economy right back into a Great Depression.
Okay, well, what about the things we're seeing right here in the U.S. economy? Because, you know, you've reiterated a number of times that we have the best house in the global neighborhood. What are you seeing here versus elsewhere?
Well, number one, I would say the leading economic indicators are mixed, John. You have the ISM in negative territory contracting. You have a slowdown, the ISM service sector. That's one that we're closely watching. So it's sort of a mixed bag. It tells us that the economy is still growing. But I think in terms of this business cycle, the economy has already peaked. In other words, at this point, we're entering in the final stages of a business cycle. I mean, if you look at things like corporate profits, they peaked in the summer of 2014. If you want to take a look at the peak in credit spreads and interest rates, they peaked in 2014. And it's no coincidence then in 2015, what did we see? A lot of uncertainty, volatility, and turbulence. So we've already seen, in my opinion, the peak in economic activity. From this point forward, you're going to see lower and lower rates of economic growth until at some point, we think at some point next year, we are probably going to be in a recession. We've already seen a peak in profits every single quarter when we go through corporate earnings season. Yes, as usual, companies beat estimates, but they're beating estimates. So the projection of profits is declining along with the decline in economic growth. So those are two areas right now. I mean, you still have a growing economy. I mean, it's still positive. That's the good news out there. But I think anything that you're going to see on the economic front is going to be more positive on Main Street than it is on Wall Street. And the reason being is lower gasoline prices. That's a stimulus to consumers. Consumers benefit from that. A lower unemployment rate, consumers benefit from that. Lower borrowing costs, consumers benefit from that. But in terms of what's going on with corporations now, a rising dollar that we've seen since the summer of 2014, that is hurting corporate profits. And here's the key thing. Even though we're seeing that the unemployment rate has come down to 4.9%, a lot of that has to do with participation rate, and also the kind of jobs that are being created. We're losing high-paying jobs in the manufacturing sector, in the energy sector, and they're being replaced with leisure-type jobs like in the restaurant industry that are lower-paying jobs. So the composition of employment has improved, but it's changed to lower quality jobs. And the one thing that we know historically, anytime you see a peak in corporate earnings, usually with a lag factor, that ends up showing in rising unemployment 6 to 8 months later on.
Okay, well, that's corporate profits. They've peaked. What about the labor market? Anything showing that that might be peaking out as well or even reversing?
Yeah, it was rather interesting. The markets kind of rallied over last Friday's unemployment number where we had a lot more jobs created. But if you looked and did a deep dive within the employment numbers, there are two trends that we're spotting that spell trouble as ahead for the labor markets. One was the decrease in temporary employment, and that is usually the first sign, because what do companies do when they start to scale back and they want to slow down? The first thing they do is they cut back on temporary employment. So we're already seeing that take place right now. So we saw a big drop in temporary unemployment, and we also saw a drop in the hours worked each week. So what companies do before they start laying off, the first thing they do is they let go of their temporary workers. They get let go, but they're still keeping their employed workforce. The second thing they do is they start cutting back on overtime hours and cutting the hours worked. So those are two trends, John, that we're starting to see develop. And it's usually not too much longer that you could see, I would say by mid-year, maybe even by fall, that we start to see not only the number of jobs created start to decline noticeably, but also you start to see a rise in the unemployment rate. So are we seeing that right now? So as I mentioned, we have several factors. We had the credit market peak in 2014. We had profits peak in 2014. And we also seen that the labor market is now starting to weaken. It's done so with the lag. And so that'll be interesting when we get the March unemployment numbers, if we see this trend continue. In other words, temporary employment continues to fall and the work week begins to be shortened. And that will tell us, John, we're on track and heading slowly into a recession. Because remember, at the bottom of a recession and a recovery, or at the peak of an economic cycle, nobody rings a bell. And these are kind of the telltale signs that you look for that spells that we're heading into trouble down the road.
So, Jim, if we look at the things you've just cited, are they responsible for a lot of the volatility that we've seen in the financial markets that was both last fall and at the beginning of this year, too?
One of the things that we have talked here on the program is we're seeing a contraction in global liquidity. Part of it has been central banks like the Bank of China and, let's say, Saudi Arabia that have been divesting themselves of their foreign currency reserves to the tune of almost $1 trillion. That's withdrawing liquidity from the market. And the Fed's ending of taper, I mean, you think about it, that was $80 billion a month that was going into the financial markets that is no longer there. Now, we're seeing it in Europe, but if you take a look at something that we follow and we post on our website, is we follow on our Bloomberg screens the Bank of America Merrill Lynch's Global Liquidity Tracker. And whenever you see this get into negative territory, you've seen a peak in the S&P. We saw it go into negative territory in 2007, and by the fall of that year, the stock market had peaked and was now entering into a bear market. We saw it go into negative territory in 2011. That was the first 20% correction that we'd seen in the stock market. And now it has entered into negative territory again. So this is a composite indicator that we add our own aspects to it, and it follows liquidity conditions not only in emerging markets, but also developed markets. And it's really our global liquidity tracker, which is following what is being done with central banks. And you've seen this with what has happened to market spreads, asset prices, and monetary and credit data with different frequencies depending on where you're looking. In Europe, you've got some degree of liquidity expansion, especially what, you know, basically Mario Draghi just took out a double bazooka this week in terms of what he announced. But at the same time, one hand, he was giving the markets what it wanted. On the other hand, he said, but, you know, I'm not sure we can lower interest rates any further. So on one hand, he was giving it. On the other hand, he was taking it away. So, I mean, we follow these liquidity positions because what does a bull market need? It needs to be fueled with liquidity, money coming into the market, chasing asset prices. That's what drives stock prices higher. Removing money from the market, what does that do? That means people are selling. It drives prices down. So we're seeing global liquidity, John, begin to contract. It's a negative territory, and that's a warning sign. And that's why even some of the technicians we've had on the program, including Luis Yamada in the first hour, see this as nothing more than more of a bear market rally than anything else. Now, people like Tom McClellan, who we had on last week, says he thinks we're going to have another major downturn going into the summer, maybe another hiccup as we get into the fall, as we get closer to the election. Policy will be enunciated as we have our candidates for each party. You always get a little nervousness on the markets depending on what each candidate is saying. It's interesting because Barron's did an article on the different candidates about who would be the most market friendly. There's maybe one that's more friendlier than the other, but, you know, there's nothing really great out there in terms of talking about policies that would really work well on a physical front and work well with monetary policy to stimulate economic growth rather than take from economic growth. So, John, one major factor right now is global liquidity is contracting.
Okay, if the LEIs are mixed here in the United States, what about the LEIs globally?
Same thing. We're seeing a contraction, which is why you've seen recent warnings come out from the IMF. I mean, almost every single month here since the beginning of the year, the IMF or the World Bank or the Bank of International Settlements has been out there warning that, you know, economic growth rates are slowing down. And two articles this week, China's slowing down its economic estimates, and economists are slowing down their economic estimates for growth this year for GDP here in the U.S. and other major economies around the world. So take the big four, the U.S., China, Europe, and Japan, and every one of these economies is slowing down, and it's taking Draghi to come out with double bazookas this week because there's a slowdown in Europe as well. So the global LEIs are slowing down, but even more so than that, you know, a couple other things that we take a look at are CFO surveys. These are chief financial officers. So if cash flow is contracting, sales are contracting, you know, who's going to see that first but the chief financial officer of a company? And also we're seeing this in small business confidence surveys. And because, let's face it, small businesses are the job creators in this country. Most of the time, major corporations are not the big job creators. It's small business. And you take a look at small business confidence surveys, they've been in decline. CFO surveys, they've been in decline. So you're getting hints here and there that corporations are beginning to sense trouble. And you're already seeing that reflected, as I alluded to early, that they're starting to cut back on temporary employment. They're also starting to cut back on hours worked. And so that tells me the labor markets are starting to slow down. And I would suspect, John, if this trend continues, we're going to watch this closely. But we're watching the LEIs, we're watching global liquidity, and we're watching the CFO and confidence surveys, and then also these underlying indicators within the employment report, because the drop in unemployment, the unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. It's not a leading indicator. And so what's important is to take a look at the composition of that unemployment report, what's happening within it. And that is telling us that there's trouble ahead.
Well, we're back to the question we keep asking. Given everything that's happening right now, do you think they go on pause or proceed?
I think they're going to go on pause. They're going to hold back. But what you worry about is if the market continues to rally as it does, and I think this is a bear market rally, then what the Fed can say, well, the stock market's doing better. It's looking pretty good. All they need is a little improvement. And they might say, okay, I think we can put another rate hike. So the consensus has now moved, and we're doing the same thing that we did last year. We've moved the first rate hike to June now. We've gone from at the beginning of the year, we thought they were going to raise in March. Now that's been postponed to June. You have some that the futures market is saying that, look, if you're going to go at all, it's maybe one and done for the year, and it's probably going to be later on in the fall. It's unlikely as we get closer to a presidential election that the Fed will want to find itself in a position, especially, John, you saw both parties attacking the Fed chairman last time she was on Capitol Hill. You can imagine politicians, if we get to summer, if the unemployment rate is starting to rise, the economy is starting to slow down, the party in power knows that's curtains, and the White House knows that spells doom for a presidential election is to have a weakening economy going into the fall or a faltering stock market. So I think they're going to be on pause. I think it's just too fragile now because they got to be cognizant of what's going on overseas. And then also, you know, with the ECB bringing out double bazookas with what they did this week, they know that if they tighten, that is really going to tighten even more, because what it'll do is it'll strengthen the dollar even further, which will further hurt corporate profits. I mean, we already have the unemployment market starting to weaken. What do you think is going to happen if corporate profits continue to decline? Eventually, we're going to be talking about layoffs, and that one of the Fed's mandate is to maintain full employment. And here they would be pursuing policies that would be raising the unemployment rate. So I think they're going to go on pause. And whether they go again in the fall or maybe the summer, a lot is going to depend if these economic numbers swing around which they have been apt to do here in this economic recovery. How many times have we seen negative economic rate or a slowdown in the fourth and first quarter and only to see economic growth resume in the second and third quarter? It happened in 2014, where we had 5% economic growth. It happened again in 2015, although at a lower level. And that's why it's our own contention that in terms of this business cycle, economic growth is already peaked. And so we're in the final phase of this business cycle before we head into recession territory, which we think could be sometime next year.
Well, given the fact that we believe we're headed towards a recession and that there's a storm on the horizon, we always bring it down to investment. So as an investor, what would you be doing?
I mean, we've been getting defensive. You know, I've talked to here on the program that because we think we're towards the peak of a business cycle, normally what happens at the peak of a business cycle, you start to see a rise in interest rates. And we've seen that begin in the last quarter of last year, where credit spreads began to widen between sovereign debt and corporate debt. So we've been staying short term in the 1 to 2 year range. And I mean, the bonds that we had last year, you know, where we were getting 2 to 3%, we're rolling those bonds. This year, we're getting 3 and 4%, in some cases, 5 and 6%. And so, John, we are loading up and building our short-term bond positions as a defense. And the reason we're doing that is because of the risk to cash from negative interest rates, the new rules regarding money market funds that could break the buck. And we're trying to get a rate of return. I'll take 4 or 5%. Or 3 or 4%, depending on whether we're going 1 year or 2 years, over just sitting in cash and earning nothing. We're doing that. Our stocks are more dividend paying consumer staple type stocks that are more defensive, which do well towards the latter part of a business cycle. But they too, at some point, will peak. And we're also essentially looking at the gold markets from a tactical point of view. And especially if these global trends of lack of confidence in government, negative interest rates persist, and if we start to see more turbulence in the market ahead. I think right now, even though we're seeing a run-up in the price of oil, we're seeing a run-up in precious metals and some of the commodity sector, a lot of that's going to be a trade other than what we see in precious metals. So we see this more as sort of a bear market rally. Now, whether this turns into a bull market down the road, if monetary policy changes, which could happen, but right now we're playing defense and we've been doing that since November of last year. And as this year progresses, if the trends that we're talking about, our LAIs weaken further, global liquidity tightens further, CFO surveys get more negative, small business confidence drops tremendously, all of these things are telling us we're heading towards a recession. And what do we know that happens in a recession? Corporate profits contract. Stock prices contract severely. I mean, you know, we've held up pretty good. We were down almost 10%. We've rallied. But when you get into bear market territory, you're talking your average bear market is anywhere from over 20% to as much as 45%. I don't think if we get into a recession, it's going to be a deep one like the financial crisis that we went through in 2007 and 2009, because we don't have a lot of excesses like we had in the last two bear markets, technology in 2000 and the housing sector in 2007. There are not a lot of excesses out there right now, but nonetheless, in a recession, stock prices fall with lower economic activity. And that's why I think it's time to start playing defensive. We've been doing it since November, and we're getting more defensive as we speak.
Well, next week, Janet Yellen will be yelling again at Congresspeople back up on Capitol Hill. I don't know. You know, you're right about what you said earlier, that you had both parties grilling her this week rather than one being sympathetic and the other not. That was significant. So we'll see what happens this coming week. I think that's it. Anything else on the horizon?
We got the Fed FOMC meeting. This one's important because it's their first forecast revision that they'll make for 2016. So everybody's going to want to take a look at those dot plots, which are future projections of where they see interest rates going over the next 2 to 3 years. We'll be looking at that. We'll be looking at any revisions they make to GDP growth and unemployment. So we'll be watching that. And then also, coming up a couple of weeks ahead, we will be ending Q1 for this year. So any company that's having difficulties in the first quarter, you're going to want to air out the dirty linen a couple of weeks before the quarter closes so we can play the corporate earnings game. You get out your dirty linen, the analysts come and reduce their earnings estimates, and then you could come out and report lower earnings and beat estimates. So we got corporate earning warnings coming up for the end of Q1, and we got the FOMC meeting, so we'll have a lot to talk about. And we're going to be following these economic indicators to see if they're confirming the gathering storm that we see building, both in the economy and the financial markets. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.